Hello, this is the seminar podcast on dishonest assistance and owing receipt, headed Breach of Trust. No, we won't be doing question 5 on this seminar because we haven't done tracing in time in the lectures, and tracing isn't examinable per se. We're only going to cover tracing at all to remind you of it. Okay, so tracing isn't to be covered in this seminar. Right. Our primary focus is on the liability of strangers, so-called, is on dishonest assistance and knowing receipt. Let's remind ourselves of the two tests. Dishonest assistance first. What's required for dishonest assistance is that there is a fiduciary duty which is breached, and that the defendant has assisted that breach of fiduciary duty in some way. And the cases don't really go into any detail about what assistance means, so we just discuss it. We might even say, do we think it goes too far in some circumstances? The real question is dishonesty. We have to divide in two. The leading approach, I would suggest, is the approach in Royal Brunei Loans against Tan in the Privy Council. It was also applied in Dubai Aluminium and Salam in the House of Lords. That was then followed by the Privy Council again in Barlow Claus and Eurotrust, and purportedly followed by the Court of Appeal in Abu Rama and Abacha. This approach is Lord Nicholls' approach in Royal Brunei Islands against Tan. It's an objective approach. So when we're deciding whether or not someone has been dishonest, we have to ask, what would an honest person have done in the circumstances? And did the defendant do that? If a defendant doesn't do what an honest person would have done, the defendant is dishonest. It's an objective standard, according to Lord Nicholls, yes? So my suggestion is, you apply that to the facts, come to a conclusion. There is then the alternative approach set out by Lord Hutton into Insecture and Yardley in the House of Lords, which says that the test for dishonesty should be, first, what would an honest person have done in the circumstances? And then secondly, did the defendant realise that honest and reasonable people would think that his behaviour had been dishonest? So you're only going to be liable, says Lord Hutton, for dishonesty if you have appreciated that other people, honest people, would think that you were being dishonest. And if you didn't realise they would think that, then apparently you're not liable. And this is, of course, what the defendant in Barlow Claus and Eurotrust argues, disingenuously, I'm sure. And that's why the Privy Council in Barlow Claus and Eurotrust say we should return to the approach in Royal Brunei Islands against Tan. So all this is quite easy to apply to the facts of questions. Simply looking for what would an honest person have done in the circumstances. Part of deciding what an honest person would have done in the circumstances in relation to finance law might be, this is your big commentary discussion point, might be, if financial regulation such as the money laundering regulations requires you to investigate into the source of funds, if conduct of business regulation requires you to know your client, assess their level of expertise and so on and so forth, then shouldn't that be a statement as to what an honest banker would do? If you fail to do that, shouldn't the law treat you as being dishonest? And so this is cases like Cowan de Groot and Eagle Trust, which says that if you act in a commercially unreasonable manner, that will lead to you being found most likely dishonest. Okay? The other claim, knowing receipt, we have to show that you have received property. There's some difference between LAJU and Dollar Land Holdings, which says that receipt involves beneficial receipt, says Lord Justice Hoffman, which seems to suggest you have to become the owner of that property. Whereas all that Mr. Justice Millett required in Ajib Africa and Jackson is that you take the property into your control or possession, which is much easier to satisfy. You don't have to be its owner, you simply have to have it under your control. My personal view is I prefer the second one, but there we are. And then it's a test of knowledge. After Ream Montague, the knowledge we have to look for is one of the three categories set out in Baden and Société Générale. that either you've got to show actual knowledge, you've got to show that the defendant willfully and recklessly failed to make the inquiries that an honest person would have made, or you've got to show that the defendant willfully closed their eyes to the obvious. This is the formulation used by Leo Price QC in front of Mr. Justice Gibson in the Baden case. So it's actual knowledge, willfully shutting your eyes to the obvious, willfully and recklessly failing to make the inquiries which an honest person would have made. I suggest you use these tests as though they were legislation. It's always going to be the second and third one that matters. Have you shut your eyes to the obvious willfully? Have you failed to make the inquiries an honest and reasonable person would have made willfully and recklessly? So what are the inquiries an honest and reasonable person would have made, and did you make them? In re Montague, of course, you're entitled to forget, apparently, according to Vice Chancellor McGarry, things that you once knew, which is why we think of this test as being a far more subjective test than the dishonest assistance test. This has been complicated ever so slightly by BCCI and Akin Daly in the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Norse, who says we must decide what somebody knew, and then on top of that ask whether or not they acted unconscionably. So Chief Akin Daly did know of circumstances which perhaps would have put an honest person in an inquiry, because the terms of his contract said he wasn't entitled to receive anything like as much money as BCCI paid him. But it's held on the facts that he hadn't done anything unconscionable. Yeah, these are the profits he was given by the bank. He had no reason to know that there was fraud going on inside the bank at the same time. And so because he hadn't acted unconscionably, his knowledge, or his constructive knowledge, wasn't enough to fix him with liability. So, let's look at question three. We've answered question two as a result. Question one, in what circumstances will a bank or investment firm be a fiduciary? We've talked about it a lot in the lectures, but question three is the big one really here. Joanne was a senior trader with Sword Blade, an investment firm, and one of 30 members of the board of directors. Sword Blade is regulated by the FSA. She has personal responsibility for all investments made through Suntopia. Hector contacts Joanne in March by telephone. Says he's the trustee of a group of Suntopian investment funds. He wants to invest £5 million on behalf of this trust. He provides her with documentation. And it also shows the trust's total investment capital is about £100 million. He forwards the investments as he's supposed to. The profits then go back to Suntopia. But in December 2008, Hector flies to London and meets Joanne for the first time. He says there's going to be huge expansion, the amount of money that's coming through Sword Blade. She says she's very keen to help, she would be. He's going to pay about £20 million a month now through these funds. But those amounts are to be transferred into US dollars and paid into accounts in Panama, Cayman and British Virgin Islands, she agrees, asks no further questions. She earns her usual commission from Sword Blade. When the other directors say, what's going on? She says, my personal moral code is that I follow their instructions completely. The other directors are very angry, but she refuses to change her mind. Then we find out that Hector's stolen all the money from the trust and he and the money have disappeared. Now, we will have to sue her for dishonest assistance, Joanne, because she doesn't receive any of the money. All the money is paid into the bank accounts of Sword Blade, the firm. Which means we're going to have to sue Sword Blade, the firm, for knowing receipt, because it's only Sword Blade that can have received the money. Yeah? So let's do Joanne first for dishonest assistance. Has she assisted this breach of fiduciary duty? Well, there is clearly a breach of trust in the background here, because Hector is a trustee, and in breach of that trust he seems to have looted all the money out of the fund. So there's a breach of trust, nice and clearly. Has she assisted it? Well, yes, she organises all of the payments through Sword Blade, so it would seem that she's assisted. A natural meaning of that word. So is she dishonest? So we have to ask first, what would an honest person have done in the circumstances? What we don't find out is, given there's FSA regulation here is whether or not she has done all the conduct of business assessment of Hector and the firm, whether she's done enough due diligence as to who this client is. Money laundering regulation requires, if you remember under the money laundering regulations 2007, that she does due diligence. Now, if we put all of that financial regulation to one side, then what have we got as to what an honest person would have done? Well, she's contacted by Hector, nothing odd there. He provides documentation to her. What we'd want to know is whether or not that's sufficient documentation. You know, are there things that are missing? But we're told that he's investing 5 million out of 100 million, so that doesn't sound necessarily out of order. Everything goes well through 2008, doesn't look like there's anything odd there, the payments come, they're invested, the profits go back to Suntopia, so this all looks perfectly normal. So when Hector arrives and says he's going to up the amount of investment, what would an honest person have done? And this is a difficult one for a banker, of course, so what you don't want to do is send someone away saying, I suspect you, this is awful. So possibly Joanne does nothing wrong when she agrees, of course she'll do, take on Hector's business. Would an honest person have been comfortable with the sudden increase in the size of the payments from 5 million to 20 million? The fact they're being made over 5 months, and she does know, or she certainly did know, that the total capital was 100 million, in other words, the fund would be exhausted in 5 months. Is that something that would put an honest person on inquiry? Would that make you say, what's going on? Are you investing the whole fund with us? What's happening? So that he wants to increase the amount of investment, maybe that seems that, you know you're a good investment manager, obviously he'd want to do that, but the entire fund that quickly? Okay, maybe that's sensible, maybe you've done a good job, maybe you've made lots of profits, maybe this is a sensible thing for want someone to come and invest in you. If you spend a lot of time trying to get him to invest in you, then maybe you think this is a good thing, maybe that's what an honest person would have done. But then, instead of all the money going back to Suntopia, we're told we've got to transfer into US dollars, pay it in small amounts into lots of different bank accounts in Hector's name. The payments to be made in, I would suggest, jurisdictions that are known to be suspect. The OECD lists on all these things will mention jurisdictions like Panama, Cayman and British Virgin Islands regularly. They're known to be tax havens and so on and so forth. So that's suspicious, but accounts in Hector's personal name? If he's a trustee, are we comfortable? This huge amount of money into Hector's personal name? Transferred into US dollars? Why? All of that, I would suggest, an honest person is going to throw their hands up and become worried. Joanne agrees. She asks no further questions. Now that, I think, is problematic. I think an honest person would certainly have asked further questions. All investment involves risk. Imprudence is not dishonesty, although imprudence may be carried recklessly to lengths that calls into question the honesty of the person making the decision, says Lord Nichols. So is she now starting to act imprudently? So that's a big question on these particular facts, but it's one that comes up in the problem questions I've suggested quite a lot. Is she acting recklessly to an extent that will call her honesty into question? The end of that passage, Lord Nichols then also says, if you stand to make something from the transaction yourself, for example, I would suggest a commission like Joanne earns here, then that will also tend towards a finding that you'll be dishonest. However, if this is Joanne's usual commission, then maybe there's nothing out of the ordinary for that. If this is what she ordinarily gets, then maybe this doesn't make her particularly dishonest. However, again, if what she's on is a percentage, and it's a percentage now of £100 million rather than a percentage of £5 million, then we might think actually her honesty should be called into question on that basis alone, because there's such a huge amount of money involved. So on the objective honesty test, I think she's going to fail. The twin sector approach, Lord Hutton says, you have also to realise that honest people would think you were being dishonest. This is basically what Henwood argues in Barlow Claims and Eurotrust. The bit about my personal moral code in relation to clients that I follow their instructions completely. Hector's instructed me to maintain complete confidentiality. That's an argument which Henwood might have run in Barlow Claims and Eurotrust. What Joanne would argue is, I didn't think there was anything wrong in this because my own moral code says I do whatever the client wants. And therefore, on the basis of Lord Hutton's test in Twin Sector and Yardley, she would say, I thought this was absolutely fine. Yeah? An argument that's only going to work on that test, it wouldn't work, I would suggest, on Lord Nichols's test. And then she can go back through all the facts we just discussed and say, well, I didn't think there's anything wrong with this, I didn't realise other people would think there's anything wrong with this, so I shouldn't be held liable. Conclude on that approach. So I suggest you apply each approach separately, conclude on each separate approach. What you can do then, after you've concluded on each of those approaches, is to go on and say, however, surely money laundering regulation, sure of conduct or business regulation, would require her to ask questions here about why this change, where's this money coming from, did she do sufficient due diligence on Hector? So it might be that would come to a different conclusion. Difficult. If she had done appropriate due diligence on Hector and Hector was behaving honestly at the beginning, then maybe there's nothing from the start that should put her on notice. What's going to put her on notice is suddenly the huge increase in the amount of money that's being paid through her institution and this dodgy stuff about everything being paid to Hector in his name in US dollars in all these funny jurisdictions. So maybe there's not much difference on these facts between the ordinary case law principles and the case law principles with financial regulation added in. But let's get into a discussion about whether or not you think financial regulatory principles should stand as a statement of what an honest person should have done in the circumstances. Now, we've also got the stuff about her standing up to her fellow directors. She would say, I stood up to my fellow directors, it shows I genuinely believe what I was saying. Alternatively, we might say, she's so dishonest, she's lying to everyone she meets, including her fellow directors. I don't think we get much further than that. Now, Joanne's just a human being, this is £100 million. She's not going to have £100 million, I wouldn't have thought. So we're going to have to try and find someone to sue who might have. Sword blade, I would suggest. The thing about trying to attribute liability to a corporate entity is that you've got to get through the controlling mind test. Okay? So, we're trying to sue Sword Blade Bank, Sword Blade, whatever they're called, for knowing receipt. So we've got to show receipt. Well, all the money is paid into accounts held with Sword Blade, so they certainly have that money into their control or possession. If you think about how banking transactions work, the money becomes the bank's money, and all you have as a customer is a credit, a personal claim against them. So I would suggest the bank must have beneficial receipt there as well. Okay? So we've got receipt. The money clearly gets paid into Sword Blade's accounts, you know, the accounts it runs for its customers. So then, does Sword Blade have knowledge? What we have to do here is to try and attribute the things Joanne knows to Sword Blade. Now, LSU and Dollar Land Holdings tells us that we have to use the controlling mind and will test, the directing mind and will test from company law, to ask whether or not the human being, Joanne, was part of the controlling mind of Sword Blade. Now, what we get from LSU and Dollar Land Holdings is that you don't have to be in day-to-day control of the entire entity. It's enough that you are in control of a sufficiently significant transaction. And this is where, deliberately, these problems leave you in a big old grey area. She's one of 30 traders. I beg your pardon, she's one of 30 directors of Sword Blade. So, Sword Blade does have an obligation under the FSA handbook to put appropriate systems and controls in place, the CISC rulebook that we discussed back in October. So you might say part of Sword Blade's obligation should be to ensure appropriate governance over these 30 directors, that they understand what they're supposed to do. Because the argument Sword Blade will try and run is, well, she's only one of 30. And so we can't keep an eye on everybody, and we can't be taken to know everything that these 30 people know. It's not as though she is the chairman, after all, like LSU. Counter-argument would be, there are obligations on you under the FSA handbook to ensure you've got appropriate controls in place. This is £100 million we're talking about. She is a board director. So you, Swordblade, should have kept an eye on her. This is a sufficiently large transaction, like the transaction in LSU and Dollar Land Holdings, that she doesn't have to be running the entire organisation. It's enough that she is in charge of a sufficiently significant transaction that any knowledge she has in relation to that should be attributed to the entire entity. Okay, so that's your LSU discussion. If you believe that she is, therefore, in this context for this transaction, the controlling mind of the company, then anything she knows, quote unquote, will be attributed to the company. Now, we've just discussed that we think she's dishonest. Certainly, we can ask, did she willfully and recklessly fail to make the inquiries that an honest and reasonable person would have made? I think we would say on these facts, an honest and reasonable person, whereas she doesn't ask any questions at all, an honest and reasonable person would have asked, where is this money coming from, the 100 million, why is it all coming through here, and importantly, why is it all being paid out in your name, Hector, to Panama, Cayman and British Virgin Islands? Is it not being invested in anything? Is it just being paid straight through across 5 months? In which case it's not even as though there's proper investments going on. I mean, that stinks. Surely an honest and reasonable person would have asked what on earth's going on at that stage. So, she has the knowledge. If she's part of the controlling mind, her knowledge can be attributed to the whole of Swordblade, and therefore Swordblade can be liable for knowing receipt. Okay? So that's it, and then you can stick stuff on talking about financial regulation, how you think the ordinary case law principles should be stretched. We talked a lot in the lectures about account officers are not detectives, as Mr. Justice Millett in Macmillan and Bishopsgate, in Polly Peck and Nadir, Lord Justice Scott saying it's all a question about whether there's something inherently suspicious about the transaction. We might say, in financial circumstances, if there are positive obligations put on banks by money laundering regulation, by conduct of business regulation, and so on and so forth, things we've talked about in the course, then there should be positive obligations accepted as existing in the private law as well in analogous situations. So why not hold Swordblade liable, and why not hold Joanne liable? Quite so. Question four, how the judiciary imposes fiduciary liability is different from the obligations created by financial regulation. We talked a lot in the lectures about that. Go back to the first lecture. We spent a lot of time there, particularly when we talked about Lloyds Bank and Bundy. We spent a lot of time there thinking about Lord Denning saying, well, why can't we just set aside any transaction that's manifestly unfair or unjust? There's a whole load of things we can talk about there about what private law is doing that possibly provides a much more extreme philosophy on how we might treat banks, as well as obviously providing straightforward remedies for compensation, constructive trust, and so on and so forth. So that in some way seems to be much more aggressive, certainly than the light touch regulation we ended up with in the FSA. So I think that's interesting too. You know, the idea we're going to set aside transactions isn't something we get in the rest of financial regulation. It's much more aggressive at the approach that we get from Lord Denning and the very general statements we get from Lord Brown Wilkinson and Lord Justice Millett about what it is to be a fiduciary. But note how, for example, Mr. Justice Millett says account officers are not detectives, the central bank in Polly Peck and Nadir doesn't have liability imposed on it, when ordinarily a bank would be required under money laundering regulation, everything else, to work out where is this money coming from, suspiciously large transactions and so on and so forth. So there's a lot there about also saying there is a lot in the case law that is very conservative and offers no particular risk to banks. So it all depends on which model you're using. In what circumstances will a bank be a fiduciary? I discussed this in Chapter 5 in some detail in the beginning of the first lecture on breach of trust. what's interesting as well in bringing an essay about the distinction between the general law and the financial regulation, in favour of financial regulation, if you like, is that you cannot exclude your liabilities under the Conduct of Business source book. You can exclude your liabilities for your fiduciary duties, provided you aren't acting dishonestly. Authority, armitage, and nurse. So in that sense, financial regulation is sticking to its guns and won't be put off by something being put in the contract between the parties or in a trust instrument or something of that sort. There's a private law will. So I think there's a big stream in the private law. A lot of it is Lord Justice Millett. He's the judge in Armitage and Nurse, saying you can have exclusion clauses. He's the judge in Macmillan and Bishopsgate, saying account officers are not detectives. So there's a model of private law that seems to be terribly permissive of banks. Whereas we've got Lord Denning taking a very extreme approach in Lloyds Bank and Bundy about the sort of things we can do building on undue influence in relation to banks. Let's set aside these transactions if they're manifestly unfair and unjust. We've got financial regulation somewhere in the middle, doing bold, strong things with conduct of business regulation, perhaps banning exclusion of liability language, imposing positive obligations in the money laundering regulations 2007 and in COBS, but of course in practice being built on light touch regulation and maybe being as much use as the proverbial wet paper bag. Okay, I think that'll do for that seminar. I've drivelled on long enough. Hopefully that gives you some feedback. Good-o.